You're listening to The Weather Junkies.
Oh my God. Large, wedge, tornado coming up in St. Paul. A winter storm warning is in effect for our area.
The snow is expected at least another 2 to 4 inches overnight. Then that snow is
coming. The National Weather Service in Huntsville has issued a tornado warning for northwestern Massachusetts.
14 to 22 inches of snow!
Good Thursday evening to you, and thank you for joining us here on the Weather Junkies. You probably don't know who is talking. I am back. It's good to be back. I'm Tyler Jankowski, joining the show from Connecticut alongside Dakota Smith out west.
Hey, Tyler. Great to have you back. You know, I was thinking about renaming the show to The Weather Junkie because, you know, we had a little hiatus there.
I was in the doghouse.
Sorry, I just had to get a jab in there. It is great to have you back. And you were gone for a little, but you were very, very busy at the regional Little League World Series. Tell us a little bit about what you were doing over there.
Yeah, so it was quite exhausting. I had to work because of the Olympics. So I couldn't get time off. So I was working from 9 to 5, and then at 5, I would come home, change as quick as possible, and go to Little League, and I would stay there till like midnight or 1. I do a whole bunch of different things. I announce games, which I really enjoy, because obviously it's similar to what I do for a career. I enjoy that in a live aspect, in the ad-libbing, whatever. But I also help out with other operations things, such as security. I oversee the security force. I am the webmaster for the website. I am kind of the tech troubleshooter, so when any of the Wi-Fis go down, I have to figure out what's going on, whether it's a TV or the two-way radio fleet. So everything right up my alley. I mean, I just love it, and it's so hard when it ends. I always say my least favorite day of the year is the day after the tournament, because it just mixes so many things together that I love. You know, a lot of people think I coach. I don't coach. It's just the operations part of the tournament that I love. And how could I forget? One of the major roles that I have is advising the tournament officials about the weather. And I would be remiss if I didn't say I'm – in a pair, we're a team. My friend Garrett Argianis, who was also a meteorologist here on TV in Connecticut, is part of the volunteer weather team. So, you know, we advise when there's a storm coming or if lightning is within 10 miles or if we need to tarp the field. And it was a hectic week. I mean, we tarped the field when you include the softball tournament, which is in July. We tarped the field, I believe, 7 times. And as a meteorologist, providing that guidance, I mean, that is exhausting. Because for baseball, the games are on TV, and you have a lot of people that are in the stands. So, obviously, when lightning is threatening, it doesn't matter. You have to make the right call. But still, it's a stressful decision, especially when it's just rain. If it's just rain, you know, you don't want to make the wrong call and have the tarp come out. And, you know, it ruins a lot of things. A lot of people go home. They don't come back. If you're on ESPN, you get bumped to ESPNU when you pick up. So it's not easy providing guidance. And I don't provide guidance for the World Series, but they had a nasty downpour there today. And I tweeted out, I didn't envy those people that were providing whatever information they could, because it just flared up there on the ridge in Pennsylvania. So that's a little bit long-winded version of what I've been doing the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, that is a lot. Holy cow. Can't imagine how busy you are over there. And I saw you tweet out something today about a shower that went over where Little League is, and how you can never be too cautious about putting out the tarp early.
Yeah, especially when things are just flaring up all over the place, because it doesn't hurt. I mean, you could pull a dry tarp in minutes. It's not a big deal. But if you have to redo the field, that's a mess. And
yeah.
I think the really cool thing for me is, and it's similar to TV, but I think it's even better in that you see the real meteorology in action, your decision making. You know, you make a decision for lightning safety or for rain for the field, and all of a sudden, like, so many people are impacted by what you just said.
Yeah. I'm actually doing a little bit of looking into some event safety things for an upcoming podcast. So I'll probably want to get your input on that moving forward. So let's get into the show here, get into our normal routine. Weather in our backyard today, it's been a pretty nice day in Colorado. We had a little bit of a front move through, It's been pretty hot out here like normal. But it's going to get really, really chilly over the weekend. Unseasonably cool temperatures. Cool conditions, sorry. Temperatures cannot be cool, as John Neese once told me. And then we actually might see some snow in the mountains way up there, which is not terribly uncommon for August, but it's also not something that happens every August. And yeah, so Tyler, how's it on the East Coast?
Well, the last time I was on the show, I kept harping on the fact that we hadn't had much sustained humidity. And in my absence, we had some of the worst humidity I can ever remember here. And it was for about 5 days where the dew point was between 75 and 80 degrees. The dew point, not temperature. And the all-time record dew point here in the Hartford area is 82, I believe. And we got to like 78 for like 3 days in a row. And that was during the baseball regional. And I was outside. And I don't sweat a lot, but I was just sweating from stepping outside the air conditioning. It was just gross. But now things are settling down and the sun is setting earlier, and feels like fall is around the corner.
It is. It really is. But that also means football. So
it does. That's the one thing that I'm latching on to.
I'm going to miss baseball, though. I got to be honest. I'm a big Orioles fan, and I love coming home and just sitting down and watching a baseball game every night. But Sundays and Saturdays will be more jam-packed, more action-packed. Yeah, so let's get into our tweets. We have quite a few this week, and our main segment will be with a forecaster from the Weather Prediction Center, Brendan Ruben Oster. He did some of the forecasting for the Louisiana flooding, and that's a pre-recorded interview. We'll do that in a bit. And we'll also have a tweet dedicated to some of the Louisiana flooding. But first, we have a tweet from Jason Farlow. He wrote a piece on his blog / website, and the tweet says, Allen County warning demonstrates why tornado sirens aren't your best alert source. And it shows a map here of a tornado warning polygon, and a little bit of the polygon gets into a county, Allen County, Indiana, and it sets off sirens for parts of that county. It really goes through it very in a lot of detail to show where the sirens are and where the tornado warning actually is for. And it's only because that polygon got into a little bit of that county to set it off. So this was widely shared this week. Really great write-up. So thanks for doing that, Jay. Tyler, do you guys have tornado sirens, issues in the Northeast?
We don't have sirens that I know of. I do know that there are a number of volunteer fire departments that have sirens to signify a call coming in. And it's possible that some of those departments use them for weather. I don't know that, though. I don't think so. But this is, if you look at the maps on this link, it's horrendous. The county is huge, and it's only clipping it. I almost wonder why they included the tornado warning for that county, because I know a lot of times the Weather Service offices will clip the warnings, almost like it's the old days. Where they don't go into the new county when it's not needed.
Yeah, and even that looks weird at some points, but then you realize that they're doing it for
a reason, yeah.
Like this, yeah. Yeah. I guess they, missed that or felt like they weren't
going to
do that.
Maybe it didn't matter. This brings up another point, kind of adding to the weather in our backyard segment. We had our first tornado here in Connecticut in the last couple of years. It was last week. It was an EF0, and we didn't know about it until an hour after it happened. So just a little fun fact. It was very close to a leaf pile spinning around in the fall. It was not very much, but it was a tornado.
Yeah. So let's get on to our next tweet here from Kelton Halbert. You can follow him at Tempest Chasing. He's a student, an undergrad student in the University of Oklahoma. And his tweet says, once you learn this one trick to buoyancy, nothing will get you down. # weather clickbait. And after that, people went crazy with the # weather clickbait, at least in the weather community. And it spewed off a ton of hilarious, hilarious tweets. Tyler, did you pick up on this?
I saw the weather clickbait # going around about long-range forecasts. But, yeah, it looks like – didn't this guy start a # before?
He did. He started the how to start a Met fight, yes. Which was also hilarious. Yeah, I wish I could be as good at making hashtags as Kelton was. Well, I'm gonna read it.
Apparently, trademark hashtags or something nowadays.
Oh, like Rio.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess this one got trending too. I did not see that one. Let's see. I was looking through for a few of my favorites. Let's see. I had a few. They weren't that great. Yeah, this one's from Jesse McDonald. You can follow her at jmezzo212. Meteorologists from your town are baffled by this new weather phenomenon. Hashtag weather clickbait. The Weather Channel's Jim Cantore saw thunder snow during a hurricane, and he won't believe what happened next. Hashtag weather clickbait. That's from Jamie Oberdeck. If you do a quick search of hashtag weather clickbait, you'll be laughing for quite some time. So let's move on to our next tweet. And this one is also kind of funny. It's from Steve Silver. You can follow him at SteveTSRA. He says he's a professional meteorologist and avid Penn State fan. His tweet says, any TV meteorologist whose station covers the Farmer's Almanac as news should threaten to do on-air forecasts by a Ouija board. Tyler, you use the Farmer's Almanac this year?
No, we don't. I do know that they followed us, though, so this is worth it. No, we don't cover the Farmer's Almanac. And whenever someone brings it up, someone has not yet. I have not gotten a question yet, but I'm bound to in probably September or October. And I got to try not to flip out.
I actually...
My mom will... I can't hear you. Can you hear me? Well, I was going to say... My mom will probably come home and tell me that she read that squirrel tails are bushy and that the acorns are big and we're going to get 3 feet of snow. Modern technology always throws curveballs, especially when the name Google is associated with it. I cannot hear Dakota right now. I don't know if he can hear me. But we are still streaming live from what I can tell here.
Tyler?
Yes, can you hear me now?
It's weird. I couldn't hear you, and I was talking a lot.
I was talking a lot, too, and I couldn't hear you. So who knows what went out over the air.
All right, you want to lead us into our next tweet here?
I was just going to add in case that didn't go out, that my mom's probably going to come tell me in September that she read the squirrel tails are bushy and the acorns are big and we're going to get 3 feet of snow.
Oh, my gosh. What about the woolly bear caterpillars?
I don't know. But, yes, the next one, we have a couple on the same topic.
Yeah.
Matthew Roan, who is an avid tweeter from Central Pennsylvania, caught a spelling error in the AFD from NWS State College. They called a storm an impressive blow with an L, blow echo. What do you have to say? You chose the tweet.
I didn't even look if they corrected it, but this is like the second time they've had a big mix up this week, I think.
Mix up.
On the 15th, on Tuesday, they tweeted, an area of heavy snow will affect north-central Fulton and northeastern Bedford, blah, blah, blah. And then they attached a link to something that describes the heavy snow. And, you know, someone just pressed the wrong button and typed the wrong thing in to put out. They were looking for, I believe, a thunderstorm, a special weather statement.
Confirm that it wasn't an erroneous saved tweet draft, I actually clicked on it, and indeed it says Monday, August 15th, 2016, with the heavy snow. That was hilarious. And just to make it worth it, the towns included were Shy Beaver and Broad Top City.
I know you love getting into your Pennsylvania town names.
But the other thing that I thought was interesting was they didn't issue what they wanted to issue for another 9 minutes.
And they kept the tweet up.
And they kept the tweet up.
Which I thought it was like an elaborate plan to get a bunch of follows and retweets. Because it got 41 retweets, probably more than most of their warnings get. So
it looks like two other Weather Service offices commented, we're jealous, and somebody hit the wrong button and warned Jen.
Yeah, that's I can't believe they didn't delete it, but I don't know. I guess everyone realized that it was a mistake because.
Well, imagine if it was a tornado warning and they didn't notice for 10 minutes.
Right. I don't know. Yeah, no, that would be bad. And yeah, luckily it was heavy snow. Yeah, so rough week for National Weather Service. They call it. They have blow echoes and heavy snow across central Pennsylvania. I wonder if the Campus Weather Service picked up on that this week. Our last tweet leads us right into our main topic, and it's some imagery of the Louisiana flooding from Scott Balkmeyer. You can follow him at @CIMSS_satellite. And it shows a rainfall. It's a national rainfall map, and it shows some really impressive precipitation amounts along the Gulf Coast in southern Louisiana. And then along with that, it has an infrared imagery of some of the cloud tops, some pretty cool cloud tops with, I guess, just the barrage of tropical moisture that this thing brought in. Pretty remarkable stuff down there that they got. This very scary situation. They've had a few deaths, and that's what spurred the show this week. Tyler, have you been following this?
I don't know a whole lot about it, except it was really bad. I've seen a few pictures, and I saw some rainfall reports. Wasn't one over 30 inches?
Yeah, I believe so. I don't know if I've ever seen one like that before.
But I did also see people commenting that it wasn't getting much national coverage, and I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's because of the Olympics or what.
Yeah, I feel like there's been more criticism of the coverage of the event than how everyone's handling it and the forecast of it. There's been numerous articles. I think Marshall Shepard wrote some for Forbes, and then Capital Weather Gang had some about the lack of coverage. And I think it was kind of like a perfect storm of, no pun intended there, of the Olympics going on, and we've had a lot of flooding recently. So, you know, it's not something that, I don't know, is grabbing people's attention as much right now.
I think the location and population definitely matters, because if that was New York City or Washington, D.C., it would be top story all the time.
Yeah, and that's pretty unfortunate. And then on the other side of that, I saw someone tweet out, let's see, I'll search for it, but they were tweeting how they thought, they were comparing the rainfall of this and the rainfall of Katrina. Let's see, it was Scott Sable. He's a meteorologist at Fox in Cleveland, Ohio. And he tweeted out the rainfall maps of Katrina and this most recent event. And Katrina, there was a lot less rain. That wasn't, you know, the main impact of Katrina. And he tweeted, Hurricane Katrina, Louisiana rainfall versus recent extreme Louisiana rainfall. Guess what received the most coverage? And, you know, obviously Katrina got more coverage because it was a bigger event and impacted more people. And, you know, was a bigger threat to life and property. I think he kind of backtracked. He didn't play the tweet, but he backtracked and said, you know, that wasn't what he was trying to say. He doesn't think this should get more coverage than Katrina or as much coverage, just that he thought it should get more. It's weird. I feel like there's been a lot more talk about the coverage of this than the actual coverage of this. It's kind of weird. That leads us right into our main segment tonight with Brendan Ruben Oster. He's a meteorologist at the Weather Prediction Center. He actually wrote several of the precipitation mesoscale discussions, kind of like your mesoscale discussions during severe weather. And we had some really good insight from him about what it was like at the WPC and some of the things that they were doing before, during, and after the forecast. So let's get to that right now. And now we're joined by Brendan Ruben Oster. He's a forecaster at the Weather Prediction Center, a branch of the National Weather Service in the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Brendan got his bachelor's and master's in atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UCLA. He's been with the Weather Prediction Center since 2006. It did go through a name change during that time.
Brendan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad to be here.
So one of the things we usually ask people who come on is how you kind of got your start in weather and meteorology and where you found your passion in this community.
So I grew up in Southern California where we don't get much weather, so I was more inspired by what I saw on TV on Weather Channel and such. I was used to fog and smog and fires. But I lived in Texas for a little while, got into storm chasing, and so I really got interested in this again, meteorology. And I've been an active storm chaser every year for about 2 weeks in May since 2006. And while I'm in D.C., I enjoy the winter weather aspect, which I never got growing up as a kid. And I enjoy freezing rain events, and we've had a couple tropical cyclones move on shore nearby. So it's got a nice diversity of weather phenomena to quench my thirst, as you say.
Gotcha. And so right now you're a forecaster at the Weather Prediction Center. What's kind of your day-to-day role over there? I know you said you're kind of a mesoscale focus, but what kind of things you do every day there?
So the Weather Prediction Center, by name, you can tell we have a diverse array of forecasts. We do anything ranging from surface analysis, which is our pseudo-intern desk, and ranging all the way to the medium range, where we help put out forecasts that go on grids to be used by NDF, by the National Weather Service offices. But we've also taken on a lot of other roles. We have an Alaska desk focusing on 4 to 8 day forecasting. And then kind of our bread and butter would be our QPF forecasting, which is what we are known for. And we do QPF forecasts every day. We do day 1 through day 7. And for my role, we took on this role in about 3 or 4 years ago from the Storm Prediction Center. We issued mesoscale precipitation discussions for areas we expect heavy rainfall, which may cause flash flooding. And so we've been on that for about 4 years, and we've been issuing a lot of them, especially the last couple of years.
Yeah, I noticed that you were the forecaster on a bunch of the mesoscale precipitation discussions for the most recent flooding in Louisiana. And you use some strong language in there, really, you know, making a point that flash flooding in certain areas could happen, and that these areas need to be ready for this. So I'm curious, what was it like at the Weather Prediction Center when you were issuing these mesoscale discussions for such a big event and high impact event?
So, of course, the field offices had it even a little bit more difficult because they're the ones actually issuing all the flash flood warnings and flood warnings for the event. But in terms of just putting out the forecast and following it from, because we were following this event from about day 5, it was showing up in a lot of the models, and we knew it would be a very busy set of night shifts for us. And just having that going, and we knew the meteorological setup was absolutely phenomenal for a heavy rainfall event. And the system, I don't know if everyone knew, but the system originated in the northeastern Gulf of Mexico and kind of meandered about the Florida panhandle for a few days before flooding very slowly westward. And eventually, about 5 days later, it finally settled into southeast Louisiana. And overall, we knew it was kind of a slam dunk in terms of the flash flooding occurring, even though the area is heavily influenced by swamp land, which is hard to flood. But when you have 20, 30 inches of rain falling in like a 3 to 5 day period, it doesn't matter what your soil types are, it's going to flood at that point.
Ever worked on an event this high impact? And if so, what are some of the, I guess, comparisons and contrasts from this event to other flooding events that you've forecasted for?
So in the past couple of years, two other events have come to mind. I don't know if anyone remembers from October of last year in 2015, we were dealing with the potential of a hurricane or tropical storm Joaquin coming towards the East Coast. All the while, there's also going to be a separate setup of a heavy precipitation event across the Carolinas, particularly South Carolina. And that one, like the Louisiana event, had a really strong signal in the models. A lot of the models with the GFS and the NAM and European were showing 10 to 15 inches of rain in 24 hours, which our forecasters had to take a second look at, wondering if it was just being too robust due to feedback issues in the models or what. But That was an incredible event. That was a multi-day event, which again led to, can't remember the numbers, but very high amounts. But one thing that worked in their favor was they had upslope against the Southern Appalachians, which led to even tougher issues because of the terrain-driven activity. And the other big event was one that emanated out of Maryland and in Delaware, which occurred, I think, about 2 or 3 years ago in Islip, Long Island. And they had, I think, 11 or 12 inches in 3 hours. They had 5-inch hour rain rate. They actually had 5.10 inches in 1 hour. I had never seen anything like that before.
Oh, so how long have you guys been following this before it started? What was kind of the, was it like a couple days or a week before? Did you see something setting up in the models beforehand?
So we look at, basically, we have a lot of data to look at the Christian Center. We get a lot of ensemble data, and the solutions were by like day 5 or day 6, way out in the medium range forecast realm. They're showing this like very slow moving upper low across the Northeast Gulf. I know the Hurricane Center in Miami was following it for potential tropical development, but I think they kept the percentage at 10%. So it was very low end. It was more just a quasi-stationary mid-upper level low. But we knew one thing was that moisture was incredibly high. The precipitable water values were 99th percentile, near record. And so we saw that signal. But again, it was more the speed of the system than anything. If you have that much moisture, if it's moving, at least that you can move the rainfall around. But the fact that the solutions were showing it being nearly stationary was concerning. And even then, looking back, the models are still too fast and drifting, I think, westward. It actually was even slower than that. It was even slower than any model we looked at looking ahead.
So when you are looking at the, or sorry, when you're making the mesoscale discussions, do you take into account the, I guess, at the surface things that are going on, like topography and areas of residence, areas of commercial, I know you take into account rivers. That might be more of a national, a WFO thing, but what else do you take into consideration besides just the rainfall amounts?
So I look at the antecedent conditions. I usually look at the past 7 days of rainfall, kind of see what the departure from normal is, just to see how susceptible the area to flooding. And we use flash flood guidance, which comes from the river forecast centers, but we take it with a grain of salt because even if the guidance values are high, saying that conditions are dry and can handle a lot of rainfall, we've proven to see time and time again that heavy bursts of rainfall in short periods of time can flood pretty much anything. It doesn't matter, even if the thing says 3.5 inches in 1 hour via flood, you can get it at much lower levels just given intense rain rates. And while population isn't the first and primary thing we look at to issue, we do at least consider that if we're writing a message, we might make mention of urbanized issues, but we would never issue a discussion just based on urbanized flooding alone.
I like what you said there. A big burst of rain can pretty much flood anywhere. What about specific to the Louisiana flooding? What were some of the other things that impacted the flooding besides just the enormous amount of rainfall, or was it, you know, just that?
To me, it was really just the meteorology working and the fact that the soil just couldn't handle that much rain, and the drainage systems were not, it's hard to say any drainage system should be up to par to handle 10 to 15 inches of rain in a day, because that's very hard to run all that water off and keep it away from damaging civilization. And I mean, I've seen some pretty surreal satellite images of before and after. I mean, there's so much water everywhere. And again, Louisiana, as far as I know, is pretty flat for the most part. And so, imagine if there was topography involved in this, it could have been, you know, a lot worse if the area wasn't as flat as it is.
So there's been a lot of discussion within the media and on social media about the flooding not getting a lot of coverage. And the forecasts and the science behind it is pretty objective. You know, you look at what's going to happen and you forecast for it just as much as you would forecast for something else. So I'm curious what, at the WPC, has there been anything like that? Or is it just you guys are forecasting what you see and that's pretty much the bottom line?
Well, because while we're forecasting, we do get a lot of interaction with, for us, we get a lot of media attention. We get a lot of phone calls. So while we're doing these forecasts and issuing these graphics, we're also communicating with our partners, which are a lot of, we'll get phone calls from like CBS, Radio News, Fox, and Wall Street Journal, Reuters, Associated Press. And so we often, even though we're just issuing forecasts, we're also conveying certain impacts that are occurring. They'd like to know what it's actually doing, where is it going. And at the time, like, the flooding was occurring, we didn't get too much information about that at first. It was more the aftermath. I really got to see what was actually happening. But in real time, I knew we had to be on our game, because this area was getting, you know, a deluge of heavy rainfall. And again, while we don't have the kind of stress level of a forecast office, we've actually issued the warnings and having to deal with the emergency managers in the local community. It still is a pretty intense set of days for all the forecasters.
So getting information from the ground, observations from the ground, is pretty important for you guys when you're doing some of these forecasts?
Yeah, so while I'm working, I'll look at a combination of things. I'll look at a lot of MesoNet data, because just the first order METARs that are kind of spread out across the United States. So I want to get a little more coverage of the precipitation amounts. Of course, COCO rods, but only if it comes out usually the morning when people empty their gauges and tell us how much they have. And I'll use the NWS chat, which I can communicate with the field offices and look at what emergency managers and other reporters are telling me what's actually occurring on the ground.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people miss how much communication and interactions going on behind the scenes that you don't see. Because every time I talk to someone who's working with forecasts in a high impact event, there's always, you know, dozens of people and organizations that they're talking to, and I it's a lot to keep track of. I'm impressed by the activity, how you guys keep up with all of that.
Oh yeah, I agree. Yeah, most people just see the end product, and you never know what the road was like to get there.
Yeah. So one last question we ask to everyone who comes on the show. What is some advice that you would give to someone who wants to be a forecaster or be in the field of meteorology for their future career path?
Well, one thing you definitely have to know is, like, if you know you love meteorology, that's why we're all here. We definitely recommend that you be ready and be prepared to spend a lot of time with math, physics, chemistry, and computer, especially computer science these days. Computer programming is becoming a bigger and bigger thing, because while forecasting is still what it was, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, there's a direction of the models are getting better, and just learning more about the models and using the programming languages we have access to create new tools to utilize this information has become a bigger and bigger thing. And to be competitive in, say, getting into a meteorology job, it seems like bachelor's degree is no longer sufficient. Most people come out with master's degrees at this point. That's one of the reasons why I stayed to get a master's degree. I realized it's getting uber competitive. And then besides just the meteorology itself, there is also the lifestyle. The lifestyle is a big thing. Like, you have to do shift work. And I didn't realize what that really meant until I got into it. I rotate every 4 or 5 weeks. I go through sets of day shifts. We start really early to go to evening shifts. And eventually I do a set of second night shifts, which take me home in rush hour. And so it takes you away from family, friends. And so you have to really enjoy what you're doing, and because it does require a huge lifestyle change and have a lot of impact on you.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think a lot of people don't realize the shifts and the days that you'll be working and the hours that you'll be working. So, you know, thanks for that, because I would have, I don't know, that would be quite the adjustment, I think, for most of us. So thanks for that.
Oh, yeah.
And thanks for talking with us.
I'm a night owl myself, but being up till 6 or 7 a.m. is a different story.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much for talking with us, and best of luck with the forecast over at the Weather Prediction Center.
Oh, sure. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks.
Back
That was our interview with Brendan, Ruben Oster, and great talk. Really learned a lot about some of the operations of the WPC and some of the things that he has to do there and some of the behind the scenes that you don't see. You know, they're talking with a lot of people during situations like these. They're talking to media outlets. They're talking to emergency managers. They're talking to WFO's local weather forecast offices. And you know, the list goes on and on that we don't really see. All we see is the forecast and the product. But really, they have a lot going on over there. So thanks again, Brendan, for taking some time to talk with us. He actually mentioned that he was the Weather Geek of the Week on the Weather Geeks, the show by hosted by Dr. Marshall Shepard. And I guess they just pick people. It's not something you submit to. You get picked, and I think you get recommended by someone. So that's pretty cool. Maybe one day one of the weather junkies will be the Weather Geek of the Week. So that was a good, really cool interview.
Yeah, neat to have him on. I don't think the Weather Prediction Center gets as much love as the Storm Prediction Center, but I will say I go on their website every day.
I think you're right.
One of the things I love is their fronts that they draw, because you know a human has actually looked at things and put something together. So that's usually a good starting point for things. But it's always fascinating to me that everyone clings to the Storm Prediction Center outlooks, but the Weather Prediction Center issues outlooks in mesoscale discussions too, but I bet you a lot of people don't know that.
No, I think you're right. I actually didn't know they did the precipitation mesoscale discussions until the other week. But I think they're just as important, especially for situations, you know, like this. I'm curious if they, I know the Storm Prediction Center does the winter weather mesoscale discussions. I wonder why the Weather Prediction Center doesn't do those, or maybe they are going to start doing those instead of the Storm Prediction Center.
You mean this SPC issues stuff during a winter storm?
Yeah, yeah. And it would make sense to be at the Weather Prediction Center instead.
Isn't it always convection based?
Yeah, I guess you're right. But I mean, so was the, well, I guess, yeah, I guess you're right on that.
It's an interesting battle between the same organization. Well,
I guess it doesn't really matter as long as it gets out.
It's very cool though when you see a mesoscale discussion in a snowstorm.
Oh, that's when you know it means business. You look for they always mention if there's a chance of thunder snow, and that always gets me going. Just a side note here, he's the second Weather Prediction Center forecaster we've had on. Do you know the other one?
Paul Kosin.
Hey, there you go, yeah. Yeah, I was looking through the staff directory the other day, and I was like, oh, hey, we've had someone on before. And he actually usually does the Alaska office forecast, I believe, most of the time. So they get some snow up there for him to forecast for. That's a specialty. So I wanted to do a few plugs here before we sign off. We have a new website. Well, we have a website. It is new, but we never had one before. So it's theweatherjunkies.com. And before every episode, we'll put a blog post up with the main segment and some of the tweets that we're going to talk about, so you can follow along there. We also generally tweet out during the show what we're talking about. So you can follow along two ways if you want, but the blog post makes it nice and easy to just scroll down through the tweets. And there's also a link there to go to the YouTube page to listen in. And yeah, I think that's all I had. We will have another episode next week. And we'll also have another episode of Weather Ready or Not, starting to make that a monthly thing. And we're also going to add on someone to the team for those podcasts. Look for that announcement later in the week. So if you're not following us on Twitter, you can follow us at the WX Junkies. We're also on Facebook. And you can listen to this podcast on SoundCloud, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, any real podcast platform that you listen to. And please give us a rating or review. I'm begging you, a rating and review, and I will be so happy, especially on iTunes. That helps us get noticed by iTunes software, which is always good. And next week we'll have on Mike Mogul. So that'll be an interesting episode, definitely different than anything we've had. He does a lot of work with education in weather and some of the, he's a CCM, Certified Consulting Meteorologist, and he does some work for court cases, which is, he's like a forensic meteorologist on the side, which is really interesting. So, yeah, I think that's it. Tyler, you want to send us off?
Yeah, thanks for joining us this Thursday. August ticking by pretty quickly. We'll have another show, though, as we said, next week. We hope that you'll join us right back here next week. But for this evening's show, for Brendan, Dakota, and me, thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Julia, we got cows.